Blog Talk Radio.
This podcast is brought to you by PEMCO Capital Management. PEMCO Capital Management provides an institutional platform for accredited investors to gain exposure in niche sectors within the distressed residential mortgage and real estate markets. Visit PEMCO Capital Management on the web at www.pemco-capital.com. Now your host of Capital Markets Today, Louis Amaya.
Welcome to Capital Markets Today in the COVID-19 podcast series. The COVID-19 crisis, like the subprime mortgage crisis a decade ago, has sparked major public interventions to stabilize the financial markets. But the Fed isn't stepping in to bail out the real estate sector, and the big losers are set to be ordinary households. This is an intro to an article titled Another Real Estate Crash is Coming, written by Sharia Ghazi, a doctoral student and researcher of political economy at the University of London. We are fortunate to have Sharia on the podcast today to discuss the article and to obtain his thoughts on how the real estate market will play out over the next 18 to 24 months. Sharia is a PhD candidate in the Department of Economics at the University of London and is the coordinator of the university's Political Economy of the COVID-19 Crisis Project. We'll get going right after this message.
As we head into a market that is uncertain at best, don't take your eye off your core competencies. Use trusted partners to assist in managing your risk so you can focus on growing your business. PEMCO Limited provides nationwide REO services. This has been and will always be PEMCO Limited's core business. PEMCO Limited has sold over 200,000 properties in the past 10 years and provides real estate services for HUD, Fannie Mae, USDA, and GSA, as well as firms in the private sector such as private equity funds, hedge funds, family offices, and servicers. So, rely on PEMCO Limited for your real estate needs to optimize your internal resources while limiting your operating expenses. From boarding to closing, our expertise and vast network of brokers, contractors, closing attorneys, and eviction attorneys will ensure your asset is managed effectively and timely, extracting the most value out of even the most difficult properties. For more information, please go to www.pemco-limited.com or email us at info@pemco-limited.com. Again, that is www.pemco-limited.com and info@pemco-limited.com.
Sharia, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Before we get started, the questions, that the article was fascinating, and again, thank you for joining. I reached out to you after I read the article, founding on the web, just doing some real estate research. But before we get started on the questions, can you give us a little bit of background of yourself and your current situation and what you're working on?
Sure. Yeah. So I'm an American citizen, but I'm here in London. At the School of Oriental and African Studies, University of London. I am in my final year of the PhD, and it's a bit strange to obviously leave the U.S. to study the U.S., but I was especially attracted to the economics department where I'm now because they use the political economy approaches and heterodox approaches, which have been specifically focusing on financial fragilities now for various sorts for a few decades. And so I thought it'd be a good place to study finance and especially a good place to study commercial real estate and its links with finance. So my PhD is on specifically commercial mortgage-backed securities and really as to trying to basically create a model to how ground rent is extracted and finally turned into coupon payments and how that sort of overall system of ground rent flowing into bond payments, how that creates profits for obviously the trust servicers, etc. So that's what my PhD is on, broadly speaking, and as well as like the history of the CMBS market in the U.S. I obviously got interested in the situation of real estate as soon as the COVID-19 crisis sort of created lockdowns, because I knew that this would mean a serious turbulence in the real estate market. So my advisor and I are basically now on that project doing various aspects. Some are covering Europe. My job is to cover the real estate sector in the U.S. So that was really the reason I wrote that article, as sort of an early warning signal.
One of the reasons I want to speak with you, because on this podcast we talk to a lot of experts in the industry that are embedded in the industry. But what I liked about your perspective was it was kind of someone outside looking in. So for any of those who want to follow along or pull up the article, it's called Another Real Estate Crash is Coming. Just Google that. It'll pop right up. So get started on the question. So how has the coronavirus impacted real estate differently, and what makes it more vulnerable than, say, the last crash?
Right. From my perspective, there's a couple of things. Number one is the general characteristics of real estate. It's obviously a more illiquid investment. It's a more illiquid financial investment. It's also one which is, it's also, if you look at housing or construction, you know, it's lumpy. It doesn't really, it's not like one unit at a time. You either, as a commercial real estate institution or a bank, you're obviously going to be thinking about developing number of properties at a time. So that obviously makes it, and which are going to come on the market at once as well. So that makes it obviously lumpy. It makes it illiquid. That's the general thing. Secondly, for me, and I'll get right to the point here, more specifically, is the role of mortgage providers or mortgage service companies. It's a very tenuous situation that banks sort of receded from basically mortgage originations to households, right? And now it's basically these sort of mortgage service companies or providers run locally, which basically depend heavily on warehouse financing, aren't that well capitalized, aren't regulated like banks, upon which the rest of the system depends. And I think that that's sort of the Achilles heel, which no one's really focused on. And interesting, you know, obviously the Fed has seemingly ignored. So I think that aspect makes obviously real estate more vulnerable in terms of like housing, but also more broadly, obviously, if businesses shut down, they can't pay their rent. If people can go to work, then they can't pay their rent. And if you don't have rent, then you can't capitalize it to get a price. And if you can't do that, then what can you really appraise the property with? So that's at least the perspective I was sort of approaching it with.
You're correct. You know, the federal government always enacts policy to cure an immediate issue that's facing us, but really don't think about the unintended consequences that those policies create long term. And also, there's always things that they miss in a policy that generally the normal American citizen is the victim of, falling through these loopholes in some of the acts they pass. So the federal government just passed the CARES Act to help stabilize the environment with this COVID-19 issue. What are, from your perspective, some of the lackings of the CARES Act that they didn't address that they should be?
Right, yeah. So sitting here in Europe, it's interesting that the unemployment rates in the UK, France, Germany, because these countries were shut down too, right? And so I think over here, a comparative perspective does help. Why have the unemployment rates not shot off? It's because they really decided to tell businesses to keep people on the payrolls and that they would pay 80% off their pay. Now, it sounds crazy, but the point was that if you don't do it, the damage could be even more lasting or bigger. In America, they went obviously for the Paycheck Protection Program to get businesses, hey, you know, here's loans. If you keep business, if you keep your workers on the job, they'll be forgiven. It hasn't worked. That's an abject failure. I think it's really poor policymaking. It's tough here, too. It's not a great thing that a lot of people's incomes have been cut, but the unemployment rate's not gone off. And then obviously there's loopholes, which is that you can keep people on the books, but just cut back their hours. Obviously, shelter is the largest component of like a working class person's monthly income, or middle class person's monthly income, and that will just make the situation in real estate even more fragile, right? So I think that was a key lacking. The other thing is and we can discuss this more, is this issue, obviously, of forbearance. Now, it was, you know, it's good that it's been granted for up to a year for, obviously, like, mortgages which have been, you know, finally, like, sort of approved or given by the government-sponsored enterprises or the VA, basically government-backed implicitly or explicitly. Those mortgages, sure, there's been forbearance, but that obviously creates issues too. I think for now it's creating this sort of really optimistic sort of optimistic expectations that, oh, hey, you know, prices are cheap, get your mortgage, get your property, this is the time. But again, the unemployment rate has skyrocketed. It's probably going to be close to 20% soon. What does that mean? Where will, once, you know, obviously this comes to an end and people can obviously be on forbearance forever, where will they get the money from? Where will the jobs exist, which have been eliminated since the last, all the jobs were created since the last crisis, which have been eliminated in this COVID crisis, all those jobs are gone, those 20 plus million jobs. Given that situation, what's going to happen to the real estate market? So I think that this is not thought through. And unfortunately, I think it's still not being thought through in Congress.
Yeah, historically, it seems to me, in my perspective, the federal government always tries to implement policy to impact the immediate need. And because
right.
we have such a short life cycle of politics and re-elections, they're really only concerned for the next year or two, but are never generally thinking long-term and the impact. So to get some perspective on what Europe's doing or the UK, the government is paying 80% of the payroll for companies. And if that is correct, how long are they doing that for?
They've not given a timeline, and there's obviously debates about that, but the point was that minimally for a short time as possible. So Sunak here, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, basically the head of the Treasury here, the VP as well, the Vice President in the system, he's obviously advocating for opening up as soon as possible. Boris Johnson, maybe it's because he got the coronavirus himself after being rather lax, he was trying to be more cautious. But yeah, it's about 80%. And then initially it was not obviously extended to people who were self-employed or contractors. And then it was extended there too. So there was a lot of hassling about, but it was considered a very short-term measure to just kind of keep the economy in some sort of stasis, right? Let's not have like a deep dive of massive unemployment. And they've been able to do that, but it's not for the foreseeable future. As long as there's a lockdown, they're going to continue on doing that. So in real estate terms, they're planning on really not doing it anymore past mid-July. That's latest, from what I can guess.
Okay, so it's not unsimilar. I mean, we passed the PPP, and then we've extended and increased unemployment benefits. I guess it's either pay more unemployment benefits or keep people on payroll. Or some type of combination. But why do you think the Fed has been hesitant to act to create a policy that protects the long term more than they already have done, or address the shortcomings in the current CARES Act?
Yeah. Well, number one, I think the Fed's been a bit deceptive, right? Because it says that it can't do more, but obviously it did more last time around, and this time around is buying junk bonds, so it can do a lot. And I mean, I don't want to be like a legalistic here, but if you read 13.3, yeah, it's there for like lending mainly. That's the final effect should be lending against certain sorts of collateral, not obviously buying securities, fall short. So I think the Fed is trying to retain its long-term central bank independence. And for that, I think it's trying to chart a middle ground between the Democrats and the Republicans, and not taking any steps in real estate on its own because of obviously the bad memories of the bailouts under the Obama years, which obviously left a lot of, you know, homeowners hanging, and obviously there was a lot of foreclosures, and the entire homeownership rate of the U.S. plummeted about 67% in those years. right? So I think it's basically trying to absolve itself of all blame and therefore work in lockstep with the Congress and obviously the president. But it's interesting, right? By trying to do that and chart that middle road to maintain or conserve its independence as it sees as a central bank, it's actually giving up its any sort of like actual independence because they don't have an independent stance, right? So you could see this in Jerome Powell, who was first asking for more stimulus. And as soon as the HEROES Act went up to the Senate in the last couple of weeks, he's backed off, right? Because the Republicans didn't want more stimulus this time around. They wanted to wait and see for longer, right? So it's pretending to have some sort of central bank independence while really, I mean, to be crass, not, you know, really like piss off the president or the Democrats. And I think this is, so it doesn't want to touch real estate, it seems like, with a 10-foot pole at times. I think that's going to leave real estate in a more vulnerable position. And the issue is if things become worse. Right now, everyone's happy. Oh, okay, it's summer season, let's buy. Sure. But in the coming year, this might mean more more really fragilities in the real estate market of all sorts that then the Fed will be later blamed for. I think that's why it's hesitant to act. It doesn't want to be blamed, again, for bailing out, let's say, the real estate moguls or the banks. It just wants to stay away from that. It's not really a long-term policy, is it? It doesn't seem like it can carry on doing the same thing forever, especially because real estate is a vital part of the economy.
Well, this hesitancy, I mean, you kind of touched on this before, with the hesitancy of the Fed to take further action jeopardize its independence from the central bank. Can you explain that a little bit further?
Yeah, sure. The Fed always operate. The Fed likes to have this mantra that it's beyond politics, that it just simply monetary policy, that has nothing to do with fiscal policy, right? But if you're, let's say, buying corporate junk bonds, you're clearly financing investment, right?
Yes.
Quite like in the quite a risky way. So it's the Fed's already doing things which go against its actual reason for existence, or so that it claims. It's literally financing the specific investment policies of or investment strategies of certain business institutions. It has claimed that no, otherwise we're sovereign. Sorry, we're independent. We don't get into politics. We don't do fiscal policy. We don't try to directly stimulate investment. Ours is just to keep the interest rate at such a manner to be the most profitable for business, right? To be the most encouraging for business. It's done a lot more than that. So it's kind of funny. Number one, it wants to claim that it's independent of politics. The other thing is it's had a very interventionist approach. And number three, it doesn't want to get too much popular anger towards it. So then it'll be buying junk bonds, but therefore not doing anything in real estate. Now the issue is if there is some sort of slump within real estate, then it'll be blamed for that. But it'd rather wait for that to happen and still not do anything on its own, because it's scared that it'll be, considered to be bailing out the real estate sector. And again, maybe leaving homeowners and renters this time, leaving them high and dry. And so it's basically stuck in a rock and a hard place there. It's central bank independence that, okay, we're beyond politics. We're basically a monetary policy technocrats. That's what we do. I personally never bought into it. And as the crisis has shown, just like in 2007, 2009, but especially after September 2008, when, things really, really like there was basically a financial meltdown happening. The Fed's never been properly neutral. It's never been entirely independent. Obviously, it's rooted in the banking sector. It's a central bank, and it's not really independent of financial markets, right?
The thinking in the industry and the policy reflects this too as well. It's all about keeping homeowners in their homes and preventing rash of foreclosures, and keeping renters, they've been forbearing evictions and that sort of thing for a period of time. And the thought is that, the real estate market is been very strong. There's been a lack of supply not a whole lot of new construction as compared to prior to the last crash. And then we have the single family rental mega funds that have snapped up a lot of real estate. So the argument that you're making is that that's a little bit short-sighted, because long-term it could have an impact on real estate. Employment goes high, credit tightens up, people can't get loans. Investors, we're already seeing some of the big single family rental funds that own a lot of real estate start to slowly sell off their portfolio, kind of taking their gain and running with it. Do you think, based on the lack of policy geared towards the stabilization of real estate, and the fact that there could be long-term unemployment, do you think the real estate sector should be more active in pushing for some type of policy to assist them down the road?
Yeah, I would think so. I think, and I think that there could be actually some common interests here, right? Of renters, homeowners, and as well as real estate sector, because I think it's been darkly ignored. The Fed is basically scared that if it does anything, it'll seem like that it's just bailing out banks again in the popular mind, or just the real estate companies, right? Like real estate finance companies, etc. And the issue is here that this sort of inertia which is being created means that the situation is obviously will become more and more tenuous, as I think, as the time goes on. And so there should be, I would personally say that the real estate sector should be pushing for some sort of a mass income transfer, whatever have you call it, people's bailout, whatever, people's QE, as it's called here, quantitative easing. But I think direct income transfers would have been much better, like what's happening in the UK. That way the unemployment rate is lower, right? People's, therefore, obviously, their credit reports will look healthier. Right, when they go and apply for loans or whatnot, they'll be able to apply for mortgages, obviously, if they're not unemployed at that rate. And I think more than that, when you're in a recession, the economy needs a serious shot of steroids in terms of like a demand boost. It needs a demand boost, and if these sort of policies increase, obviously. Like direct income transfers, as well as just, you know, really subsidizing purchases of homes, that could be a huge boost to not only the real estate sector, which would act as the middleman here, but also obviously construction and investment, and therefore direct investment, right? So I think that would be a win-win for real estate. It would be a win-win for some sort of like income transfer or massive subsidy program to buy houses. Would also be a win-win for real estate, win-win for renters, for people looking to buy a house. And it would stabilize it would obviously decrease unemployment. And it would, I think, really stabilize the situation right now. Because right now, the way the situation is, it looks very fragile. People are going to be happy already. Things like the Reed Housing Wire about, you know, like mortgage applications going up. But at the end of the day, I don't know how much there's to be happy about if people are just buying those houses because they think they can obviously claim forbearance the moment they hit some financial stress, and the unemployment rate is 20%.
The part of the result of the policies in, say, the enactment of the qualified mortgage and the non-qualified mortgage from the last crash really made it more difficult for some borrowers to get loans. So credit really tightened up, and they made it really risky and expensive to originate loans to non-qualified borrowers, which continues to increase the wealth gap, right? So the people that have money and great credit get super low interest rates, and they can start buying houses, and then the big, you know, funds start snapping up real estate. After what's happened to this with the COVID-19, when you talk about mortgage applications rising, that's primarily for refinances, right? The rates are so low. It's not new purchases. New purchases are down. So what we're seeing, again, is credit tightening up even further and interest rates dropping lower. So we're seeing, again, the very wealthy and the people that have great credit, they're buying more assets. And the renting population, it seems to be getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And so you had mentioned the government provisions for housing in the long run to all those who currently rent as a possible solution. What exactly does that look like?
Right. Yeah. So just to say about like the qualified versus the non-qualified, one of the interesting things is that as long as you get like a Fannie or Freddie mortgage is considered qualified, right? But this sort of classification system is set to expire in January of this coming year, right, 2021. So that'll be interesting. That how will a lot of mortgages become non-qualified? It just seems like another sort of spot for me, which could create serious turbulence in the residential real estate market and obviously in the mortgage-backed securities market too. So number one, I would just say that there are, it's not like we're just out of the storm. There could be obviously a second wave of the coronavirus speculation, but it should be considered a possibility. Then there's other things too. What happens when this, obviously this qualified versus non-qualified system comes to a close? Will it be extended? If so, how? And will there be a reclassification of current loans which are qualified and will they become non-qualified? That could lead to issues in January of this coming year. And to answer your question, though, I think it could be done. The way I'm thinking is that it would be basically the government would use real estate, say, okay, where is there demand for multifamily, right? Where could be actually, where could a multifamily obviously property be built? And so it would be using local real estate agents and real estate knowledge, right? Really uniting that with construction to build mass subsidized homes. But this would not be like project housing or something, which is obviously by definition has issues because you're doing something for the very, very marginalized economically, right? This would be if you have a mass home building project, right? It could be single family homes in places where the land is obviously plenty and it's cheap, in smaller towns. Elsewhere, it could be multifamily, but a massive building project like that subsidized by the government, it could be, it could be done in various ways. It could be that for maybe the bottom 10-20%, it's basically free. They have to pay minimal amounts, maybe 10-20% of the total value. For the others, it could over a lifetime, right, or something. And then for others, it could be more, right? It would be a massive, it sounds crazy, but it could be a massive subsidy, not only for the real estate sector, but for construction and for the economy. We have a very big a military budget, over $700 billion, right? And once the government's purchased those tanks, it's not like it has extra money to do something else with it. On the other hand, if you do have cheapened cost of housing, the average person, it's middle class, working class, will have more money to spend on other things, which will boost the economy. So I think that that's something which the real estate sector should argue for. And there's forces, I think political forces on the right, which are even thinking like this. People like Marco Rubio, but definitely also on the left, which are wanting to do such sorts of programs. There's talk of a New Deal or whatnot. I think this could be a very big chance, personally, for not just the real estate sector, but also for stabilizing the economy to have such a program. And to be honest, like it would also be in some ways not to be too dramatic, but reparations for what's happened to the drop in home ownership rates or what happened to the drop in home ownership rates in the second, second term, but throughout Obama's presidency. So it would be a massive government subsidization, something akin to FDR's New Deal. That's the way I think it can be done. Now, obviously, the main issue is, okay, great, like, this airy-fairy, where will the money come from? The money will come from how it's always come from in these times of crises. The American currency is the world reserve currency, right? Like, it's like none other. And the euro is obviously in serious trouble. I don't think it'll even last, in my opinion, in the next 10 to 20 years. There's basically one reserve currency, which does give the United States, frankly speaking, an exorbitant privilege to do these sort of things that other countries can't. Only a few others can, really. The pound sterling, obviously UK can do it, and Japan, right? Other countries can. So I think that's not really, I think that's a bit disingenuous when people say that there's, you know, how will we be able to pay back the debt? Well, you know, you're paying back the debt in your own currency that you produce. And on top of that, it's a world reserve currency that everyone needs for payment. And so obviously treasuries do well in being sold because obviously the coupon payments are in US dollars and they're the debt of the world reserve currency state. So I think that this is a serious alternative. It's thinking big, but I think it's a serious alternative which needs to be thought out in the long term because problems in real estate, I think, aren't going anywhere. Yeah, like you said, inequality doesn't seem to be going anywhere. And unfortunately, it's leading to this sort of weird paralysis on the part of the Fed. And at the same time, obviously, creating political instability and you know, giving unsavory forces the opportunity to get into politics. So, yeah.
That's an interesting proposal. And a couple of things. I mean, one, most people in the U.S. build wealth through home ownership. So this will help people get back into home ownership. It's not unlike what the federal government is currently doing with student loans. I mean, they lend out tons of money and have a huge balance sheet of own loans. It'd be something similar to that, except with housing. And on top of that, with the way the economy is going, with the ability to work remote, I think a lot of people would obviously take advantage of that and be able to relocate and still continue their currently working their job, which that is thinking big. And that's really interesting. Any disadvantages to such a policy like that that you could foresee?
Yeah, I mean, such a policy obviously would have to be, again, long term, right? It would have to be 6 to 15 years and probably longer as a whole to be fully implemented. So the issue then again becomes of, you know, the changing tides of political elections, what happens every 2 years with congressional elections, what happens every 4 years with presidential elections. That's so, you know, tinkering with the policies, changing it, that sort of congressional infighting, which never stops. That would be a drawback. Besides that, obviously, yeah, I think the debt will need to be paid. So that would be a drawback. But at the same time, in terms of if you look at how much of demand it would boost and therefore give a boost to the overall GDP because people would be spending more, or how investment would actually lead to obviously boosted to the economy and so therefore increasing taxes, I think those would be like seriously offsetting costs. But yeah, I mean, the drawbacks I see, maybe I'm biased here, are minor to that. I think in the long run, that would be the drawbacks are definitely worth, the costs are definitely worth it when you consider the benefits economically speaking, and in terms of just, I think, politically, political stability-wise, in the long run, right? I think the drawbacks would be minimal, but the main one, I think, in political terms, would be exactly that: what happens with really new administrations coming to power and tinkering with this program, slowing it down, increasing it at a rapid pace, other things adding to it, or whatnot. But a massive housing and home building construction program, you know, sort of similar to New Deal style, is feasible. It's just, what I think would jeopardize is like political meddling because of infighting of the between Democrats and Republicans. But as a whole, though, I think it can be still pushed for as a sort of like a civil society response to the housing crisis since 2007, 2009, and really the sort of fragile nature of the real estate market today. You know, it's, I mean, really like over 50% of mortgages are not being originated by non-depository institutions, which are really dependent on warehouse financing, kind of stretched thin. I'm surprised that they haven't even crashed yet. Like, you know, even though, you know, yeah, there is like some lending going on to them and whatnot through Ginnie Mae. Anyway, yeah, so that's what I was saying. I think that the main drawbacks are political. And to secondary level, I would say economic. Yeah, that would mean higher taxes, but those would be probably offset by the massive boost to the economy it would give, I think. And obviously, the main thing meaning that U.S. government can obviously pay the pay back its debt because worse comes to worse because it's the world reserve currency. So I think that offsets the negative of higher debt.
Well, we're just about out of time. I appreciate you coming on the podcast. Last question. What are your plans after you finish your PhD? What are you looking to do?
Well, looking to really carry on doing research, either in academia or in finance of finance and real estate. Yeah, that's really for me the way to go. Yeah, and with obviously you know, a regulatory sort of angle as to how to better regulate the housing market or to make it work for everyone and how to make real estate work for everyone in the United States.
Excellent. Well, Sharia, I appreciate your time, and I know it's
you're in
London, so it's evening your time, so again, I appreciate it. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast, and we'll stay in touch.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks a lot. My pleasure. Yeah. Thanks a lot.
That wraps up today's podcast. Interesting information from a political and academic perspective, which sometimes we need to kind of get our heads out of the current industry and step back and take a look. The article is Another Real Estate Crash is Coming by Sharia Kazi. I apologize if I'm mispronouncing the name, but Google it and it'll come up right away. That wraps up today's podcast. Capital Markets Today can be found on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and other popular podcast distribution platforms. You can also join the Capital Markets Today group on LinkedIn and subscribe to our newsletter. Thanks for listening and stay tuned for future podcasts.
This has been a production of Capital Markets Today, a leading aggregator of news, tweets, and podcasts for mortgage, real estate, and capital market industries. You can subscribe to the Capital Markets Today podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Libsyn, and other major podcast distributors. Go to www.capital-mt.com for more information and to subscribe to our daily newsletter. Find out why we have over 50,000 subscribers worldwide.